Chair presiding.
Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. This panel is used to be called the Northern Panel, but since we do overflow cases from Clark County, the rurals, we decided to rename the panel the Seda Cherry Gibbons Panel. So that's what it is today. In our first case today, we have two criminal cases today. Our first case is case number 50305, David Mitchell versus State. Ms. Malone for the appellant, Mr. Gardner for the respondent. Ms. Malone, are you ready?
Yes, thank you.
Would you like to reserve some time on this?
I would, thanks. 5 minutes or so.
Okay, I'll try to keep track of it.
Thanks. Good morning. I'm Carrie Malone, representing the appellant David Mitchell, who stands convicted of a murder that happened almost 30 years ago. The state tried to charge him with this murder way back in the 80s, but there simply wasn't enough evidence to do so. And the only thing that has changed in those 30 years is the advent of DNA testing. And overall, so the only thing they actually have against Mr. Mitchell really is the DNA. His DNA is present in the victim's room and on the victim. And I trust the panel is familiar with the facts.
We are, Ms. Malone. I realize he was a suspect along with the boyfriend that way back when this murder occurred. So wouldn't the DNA just be the ultimate corroboration of the evidence 25 years ago?
Well, that's certainly what the state argues.
Okay. Tell me why it wouldn't be. Okay.
I would submit that the DNA is there, and the reason that it looks bad is just this, speculation as to what happened or did not happen, coming from a variety of inadmissible evidence that should not have come in. In specific, I would refer to the evidence of the victim's comments. See that guy, he gives me the creeps, that should not have come in, and the evidence about the ring should not have come in. That was just leads to speculation, speculative negative inferences about what might have happened.
Why would the ring come in?
What?
Why would the ring come in when there was supposedly some type of defense that he didn't know the deceased?
There's no evidence that it's the same ring. Somebody, you know, Mr. Scott Chiari, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, said he gave Sheila a ring a couple of years ago. A couple of years later, Mr. Mitchell has a red ring. And there's no connection between the two. There's no nexus unless you assume it. And
but doesn't it go to weight rather than admissibility? Doesn't it go to weight? Isn't this one of these things where a fair inference could be either favorable to the defendant or not favorable to the defendant? So we say in our parlance it goes to the weight instead of the admissibility.
I guess, yes, you can argue that. I would submit primarily that it's overly prejudicial with not sufficient probative value and that that's what should keep it out.
Ms. Malone, I recognize that you have, at best, an uphill battle in this case, given the age of the incident. But I think what we're all leading to is, if we assume every one of your arguments to be true, and we were to say, no, that shouldn't have come in and that shouldn't have been heard, we are left with very strong evidence that without anything else, likely could have convicted your client. So how do we get around that very simple fact?
What you have left is DNA. Yep, our client was in her room. And that's all there is. There isn't anything else.
But Ms. Mullen, wouldn't...
Why does that lead automatically to assuming that he raped and murdered her?
Well, it's circumstantial evidence that the jury appears could conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty and he has a right to a trial, and that our standard of review is could a rational jury conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that there was sufficient evidence to convict him, and it seems like he got a pretty tough hurdle to get over that, to say no.
I agree, it is a tough hurdle. I think all due respect, I would submit that one of the things that's getting considered here, too, though, is his criminal history, which everyone knows is just awful. And it's, you know, really hard to get away from that. But that is exactly what should not be considered. And I think that's what comes into play in terms of spinning the existence of the DNA.
Okay, but the instruction, the jury was instructed about how to weigh the past criminal history, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, actually, the criminal history itself didn't come in before the jury until the penalty phase. I'm suggesting that it swayed the prosecution and encouraged the state to spin the arguments, say in closing, and in terms of getting evidence admitted.
That leads to a question that at least I'm concerned about. I think my colleagues are as well. What about this sentence? Do we have a problem with the sentence?
Well, you have a problem with the district court simply didn't have jurisdiction to enter the amended judgment. It has to go back for resentencing.
So it would have to be remanded
yes. For
resentencing because the appeal was pending.
Yes, the Supreme Court had jurisdiction at that point, and the district court was divested of jurisdiction. And certainly it can correct the illegal sentence, but it has to get jurisdiction back. I have been wanting to focus on the prevention of inquiring further into Mr. Furlong as an alternative suspect with respect to allowing the jury instruction, suggesting that the jury could consider the evidence of his tendencies towards violence and possibly some mental illness and sexual issues, and also on the denial of instruction number 12 regarding Mitchell's admissions, which weren't actually admissions, just remarks, not necessarily statements against interest, but I think couching the instruction in those terms makes that negative inference and leads to that assumption. And I would submit, too, that the comments that Ms. Harris made to Scott Tiari, see that guy, he gives me the creeps. Under Tabish versus State, that seems to be plain reversible error. This court said, in order for the state of mind exception to be applicable, the victim's state of mind must be a relevant issue. The relevance must be weighed against prejudice, and a proper limiting instruction must be given or objectionable testimony deleted. And here, as in Tabish, I would submit that the relevance of the statement was equivocal. So what if he gives her the creeps? Even though there was little other evidence, and I'm quoting largely from Tabish in a way, other evidence of Sheila's state of mind before her death, the statement was arguably relevant to show her state of mind at the time she made the statement, but the exception does not allow the statement to be used as evidence of the intent or conduct of anyone else. In this case, that would have been Mitchell.
But defense counsel didn't object to this. He gives me the creeps.
And I'm going to have to submit that it was plain error on that.
See, what happens with plain error, and I'm not a great fan of the harmless error versus plain error, but it doesn't give the judge a chance to correct the mistake. You know, this is one where they could say, that's an improper answer. Mind how you answer these questions, Madam Witness, and jury, you're to disregard it. You can't do it.
Right. I understand that problem. I would, as in Tabish, the defense did make an objection. I'll just have to submit that.
How about if the state argues that it's harmless anyway in view of the DNA evidence and the other evidence, what would your comment to that be?
Again, I would say there's no actual nexus between the statement and possible conduct by Mr. Mitchell. The state says it was relevant to her state of mind in that she would not have allowed Mr. Mitchell to come into her apartment. But certainly no weighing of prejudicial or probative value occurred. No limiting instruction was issued. The court should have directed the jury to consider the comments only as her perspective on that day, not as some indication of what Mitchell did or didn't do. it's just as reasonable for someone to assume that she met him later, liked him, thought he was a nice guy. You know, he's the maintenance man. Again, as is reflected in the argument with respect to a closing argument, I think just the degree of speculation. This is must be what happened. He must have maybe knocked on the door. He must have come in. He must have hit her in the face. She ran to the back room. He raped her first and then beat her. He beat her and then raped. I mean, it's all just, this must have happened, all based on the simple fact there is DNA.
You want to reserve, you have a little over 5 minutes. You want to reserve the rest of your time? Mr. Gardner, from the Carson City District Attorney's Office, on behalf of the respondent.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Gerald Gardner with the Carson City District Attorney's Office and Justice of the Court, and may it please the Court. David Mitchell received a fair trial in this case, and he was properly convicted by a jury based on competent, admissible evidence that he killed Sheila Jo Harris in 1982. While it is unlikely that any jury trial will ever be completely error-free, there was no individual or cumulative error in this case that would warrant reversal of appellant's conviction in this case. There are many issues raised on the appeal in this case, and of course, we only have time to discuss some of them. I'd like to address some of the issues that Ms. Malone seemed to want to focus on and answer any questions the Court may have on that. As an initial matter, the Court and Ms. Malone began to discuss sufficiency of the evidence. The evidence in this case was overwhelming of David Mitchell's guilt. David Mitchell's semen was found in his victim, on her clothing, surrounding a scene of brutal attack where she was beaten relentlessly with a wooden stick, strangled, and left posed, hidden under her bed in an apartment that she'd only moved into a week before. Some of the evidence that the jury weighed in determining the guilt, in addition to the DNA evidence, was this issue of the ring. And a ring was discovered missing from her apartment after she was murdered, a ring that her mother had seen before her murder, a ring that had been given to her by Scott Chiari, who also testified, and a ring, or at least a red ring, was shown to Patricia Brazier by David Mitchell two or three days after the murder in an odd scenario in which he simply showed her a ring and said, look what I have. The Court's right. This is something that the jury is entitled to weigh. I would compare this to the facts of the case of Lord v. State, which we know more for its declaration that Nevada's reasonable doubt instruction is consistent with Cage. But in Lord v. State, we have a case where a murder victim was discovered on the side of the road. 2 hours later, two co-defendants were discovered in his truck in California, bloodstains on that truck. A witness testified that those two men had stolen gas from him, and when they were caught trying to steal gas, he tried to trade them a ring, a gold ring, in exchange for the gas, which the gas station attendant refused. At trial, the victim's mother described that the victim wore a gold ring. That was admissible and was not the grounds for any reversal in that case. And I would submit that the chain of facts that connect the ring in this case are far stronger than in that case even. With respect to Sheila Harris's state of mind declarations to Scott Chiari several days before her murder, that man over there, he stares at me all the time. He gives me the creeps. It is clear that the incident that she is describing is the same incident that David Mitchell himself describes to police investigators during the investigation. And it is highly relevant. It's relevant for several reasons. First of all, it's admissible as a mind exception under NRS 51.085. That's a well-established exception to the hearsay rule. The statement was non-testimonial, so Crawford is not implicated in this case. And it shows several things. It shows her aversion to this man whose only defense at this point at trial can be that he was in her room consensually and that his semen got inside her and on her bed consensually. That's his only defense. So it shows her state of mind at the time. It also corroborates the incident that David Mitchell himself described which is very relevant for his own state of mind. David Mitchell, when he was interviewed by the police, initially denied even knowing who Sheila Harris was, said he didn't even know what she looked like. Within that same interview, a short time later, he is not only aware of where Sheila Harris lives, which apartment she lives in, he knows what she's wearing on a given day. He knows that she has a gentleman visitor on a given day. He knows what car the gentleman visitor arrived in. He knows that the gentleman parked his car next to Sheila's car, thereby knowing, obviously, which car Sheila was. Just to have that knowledge in the space of a tenant's one-week stay at an apartment is in itself significant. It's, frankly, creepy. And when you put it in the context of him just moments earlier denying that he even knew this person, it's relevant evidence.
Now, Mr. Gardner, Ms. Malone argues under Tavish versus State that the statement either shouldn't have come in or the jury should have been instructed as to the limitations. I believe the facts that you may have been in the Clark County DA's office when that was tried, but I believe Ted Binion told his attorney, Jim Brown, that if I die, Sandy Murphy did it or something like that, who was a co-defendant with Tavish in that case. How would you distinguish this one here?
Well, I think it is distinguishable, and I think Tavish is actually more in line with the Schultz case, in which the issue wasn't so much that the victim said something that related to his state of mind. What the victim in Schultz case and Tavish said was something that implicated the defendant in the murder itself. It was a statement. In Schultz, for example, the victim said, if I remember correctly, he said, the defendant's going to kill me, or I'm afraid the defendant's going to kill me. Now, his state of mind with respect to a prediction that the defendant was going to kill him was not relevant to the murder itself, because that murder may never have happened. Now, what the Schultz court did say was that if the defendant had raised the defense of self-defense or suicide or accident, then maybe those state of mind exception statements might have come in. And that's just like Tavish. Whereas in this case, what the victim is saying is that man over there stares at me all the time and he gives me the creeps. That statement in itself doesn't implicate the defendant in her murder. It doesn't suggest that the defendant had the intent to kill her. It doesn't suggest that, as they said in Schultz, it doesn't suggest the strong inference of appellant's intent, actions, or culpability. Now, had the defendant objected to the statement, I think the court might have limited the jury and said, you're only to consider that for the victim's state of mind and not for the appellant's intent, actions, or culpability. But there was no objection, and the court couldn't do that.
And the defense never asked for an instruction on that at the end of the case when you settled the jury instruction?
They did not. So the court was left with the position that they couldn't determined that there was an error that they should sua sponte correct. And I think it was harmless error in any event. I think the statement would have come in any event because it was offered for a much different reason than Tavish or Schultz. It wasn't intended to show the defendant's intent or culpability in his victim's murder. It was merely to show the victim herself had reservations about this person and certainly rebuts any implied defense that the defendant had a consensual relationship with her in that short week's time that she lived there. I agree that even without this evidence, should it have been excluded, and I don't think it should have been, there's very strong evidence in this case. The appellant in this case has suggested that there may be some tendency to blur the criminal history with the facts of this case, and I submit that number one, the jury, of course, had no knowledge of the defendant's criminal history. The state filed a motion for admission of bad acts to get some of those events in, and the court, in its discretion, denied that motion. So the jury heard nothing of that evidence in the guilt phase. I have no doubt that this court is perfectly capable of separating the evidence that supports the defendant's guilt from the evidence that supports his sentence. And certainly the prosecution was prosecuting this charge based on the evidence that was there. As you said, Justice Gibbons, the DNA was the ultimate evidence that connected this defendant to his crime after nearly 25 years, many, many years of him being a suspect, numerous items of evidence that connected him to the crime, and the DNA placed him there by a statistical ratio of 1 in 500 billion. So the question remains, based on the evidence, when viewed most favorably to the prosecution, could any rational trier of fact have found the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? And I submit to you, justices of the Supreme Court, absolutely. This defendant was convicted on fair evidence. Justice was a long time coming in this case. It took 25 years to bring appellant to justice, which is longer than Sheila Harris lived on this earth. But justice was done, and the appellant received the benefit of a fair justice system, a fair trial, where he was afforded all rights and protections of the criminal justice system. And I urge you to uphold the conviction and sentence of appellant David Mitchell for the crime of first-degree murder with a deadly weapon.
What about the, we're talking about the remand to fix the sentence?
Your Honor, the difficulty with that issue, of course, is that the statute says that the trial court can correct an illegal sentence at any time. I certainly understand the arguments regarding jurisdiction. The state, I believe, and I hate to be so colloquial, but the state was kind of in a between a rock and a hard place on this issue. We are looking at the risk of waiting until after the appeal is done, years later, then asking the court to correct the sentence, and perhaps starting a whole new round of appeals, not to mention facing issues of waiver or Lakey's or whatever arguments might be made by our failure to bring this issue to the district court's attention promptly. In fact, it was the district court who brought it to our attention, having seen this court's decision in Second Judicial District Court. So we felt it was critical that we do that. It's unclear from the rules of appellate procedure whether there's any mechanism for interrupting the appeal and bringing the case back to district court. There may be. I'm just not aware of it. If this court rules that the district court did not have jurisdiction to change that sentence, obviously we will accept that and ask this court to remand it with instructions simply to reimpose sentence according to Your Honor's decision. I would
hope be the statute in effect at the time. He's under the statute that was in effect at the time of the conviction. Oh, excuse me, the offense.
The offense.
Correct. That's right, Your Honor. We would ask this court to remand it with instructions to reimpose a sentence pursuant to Second Judicial District Court, State versus Second Judicial Court, Pullen, which was identical or very similar facts, remanding it to, in that case, the court had sentenced him to life in prison for murder and a sentence of 8 to 20 consecutive for the deadly weapon enhancement. That's exactly what happened in our case. However, in both cases, the crimes were committed before the sentencing was range was changed from a mandatory consecutive and equal sentence to a 1 to 20 sentence. The trial judge in this case, erring on the side of caution, imposed the sentence as it exists today. Then Second Judicial District Court came out instructing us that that was wrong. And I would point out the state had filed a sentencing memorandum before sentencing, asking the court to impose it under the old law, because we believe that was the correct decision. But we understand the court's decision, and we would simply ask this court to remand it if it feels it's necessary to do so and can't correct it through a bench order, directing the court to sentence the defendant pursuant to State versus Second Judicial District Court.
Did you want to make any type of statement concerning the length of time that it seems like there was sufficient circumstantial evidence to try the man years ago? How do you feel about that?
Well,
I know DNA, every prosecutor lives and dies by DNA because it gets a lot of people out of prisons and jails, too.
Yeah, it was, I suppose, of concern to us. The DNA was analyzed in 1999, so 17 years after the murder happened. At that point, I believe the defendant could have probably been tried. He was in Trinidad at the time, so there was a lengthy international extradition procedure, which took some time. Mr. Rombardo and I didn't join the district attorney's office in Carson City until January 1st, 2007, and tried this case 6 months later. It had been brought to preliminary hearing by the district attorney's office prior to us the year before. So we tried it as promptly as we could.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any questions, Justice Gibbons, Justice Sadat? Thank you, Mr. Carter. Ms. Malone, you have a little over 5 minutes left in rebuttal.
Ms. Malone, I'll be interested in how the semen evidence. How do you explain that to the jury in arguing for reasonable doubt?
How do I explain the presence of it?
Yeah.
There is evidence that this encounter could have been consensual. There was no evidence of trauma to the victim's vaginal area. It's true that it doesn't always show up, according to the experts. But there was no indication at that point that there was trauma there. It could have been a consensual encounter. Not sure. There's arguably a sort of an undercurrent of maybe racism here, saying, "Oh, she could never have been interested in this young black man." I think that's not necessarily true. She could have been. He was.
I guess it goes back to the original play, isn't it? That's kind of, it sounds to me like a jury call. You know, they have to hear all the evidence that their fact finders were not. And
right. Well, I mean, in that sense, that's one of the things that, you know, leads to the prejudicial effect of her comments through Scott Chiari regarding how maybe she initially felt about Mr. Mitchell.
How do you disagree with Mr. Gardner that the nature of the comments were significantly different than in the Tavish case, the ones about she's going to kill me,
that,
you know, like
that. If they're not showing anything relevant, they're not relevant.
They don't go to her state of mind?
They do go to her state of mind.
And therefore, go ahead. I'm sorry?
Well, no, that's all I was saying is that, but then we get into the Tavish requirements, which, you know.
Which implicated in Tavish, as I recall, those comments were implicating someone, in this
the
case,
defendant,
the defendants,
specifically.
Specifically in the act of the murder. Certainly not the case here.
Right. But on the other hand, as Mr. Gardner said, they didn't indicate anything connected to Mr. Mitchell, so then why do we care about them?
But we can't reverse every case where a witness says something nasty.
Oh, no, of course not.
You know, especially when there's no objection.
It puts us in a real bad position. Simply would just, you know, suggest that there's an accumulation of error, as set out in more detail in the briefs as well, and compounded by misconduct in the closing argument in terms of suggesting to the jury what they should find, largely. And it's incontrovertible.
Wasn't that more of a
truth,
comment on what they believe the evidence showed when they made that statement?
I think it goes beyond that. I would submit it goes beyond that. If you don't accept Jeff Riolo's discussion of DNA, then you don't accept DNA science. The police testified frankly to an indisputable truth. Without a shadow of a doubt, Mitchell is the killer. I mean, these are some of the comments that you can see in the transcript that I think do go beyond what is acceptable.
Okay.
Thank you. If there are no other questions.
Thank you, Ms. Malone. Mr. Gardner, Ms. Malone, thank you for your arguments in this matter. Very professional on both.